I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The U.S. and its international partners worked out a deal with Iran late last month that freezes its nuclear program for the next 6 months. Some sanctions will be lifted in response as the countries hammer out a more permanent deal. This is the first major agreement between the United States and Iran in several decades. We asked Joseph Cirincione to join us. He's the president of the Plowshares Fund. That's a global security foundation. Also the author of a new book called Nuclear Nightmares: Securing the World Before It's Too Late. He's a member of Secretary of State John Kerry's International Security Advisory Board and the Council on Foreign Relations. And Joseph Cirincione, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you, Marty. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So how close was Iran to making a nuclear bomb?
Well, the good news is that Iran has still got a ways to go. Our national intelligence estimate is that Iran has not yet decided to make a bomb, so this is not a crash program to get there as soon as they can. But they do have substantial capability. So if they were to decide to make a weapon, the estimates are it would take them somewhere between 1 and 3 months to make the material for a bomb with the stockpile of medium-enriched uranium that they have. It would then take them about a full year to fashion that material into a crude nuclear device, something like the bomb we dropped on Hiroshima, and then about a year after that to be able to develop a device that could fit on the nose cone of a missile that could reach Israel, parts of Europe. So using that timeline, anywhere from 1 to 2 years away from a weapon that could threaten us. And the good news is we'd almost certainly see them doing it. We have inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency there at their facilities. This would be an observable activity, and the world would have time to react.
And help us understand, the various parts of this deal. As you said, there are inspectors who are, on the ground, daily inspections in Iran?
Well, the inspections there could give you some warning, and what this deal does is toughen the inspection process. So right now, the inspectors who have been there for years visit each facility once a week, once every 2 weeks, so they would notice if anything unusual is going on, if they had switched from enrichment to low levels for fuel to enrichment for high levels for a bomb, but still, it would be weeks. What this agreement does is it changes that to daily. So you will now have a daily presence of the inspectors at the known facilities. It also does something else very important. You remember when Mr. Netanyahu went to the UN last year and drew that cartoon picture of a bomb?
Yes.
And had a red line at the top? Well, he was worried that Iran would soon produce this quantity of what we call medium-enriched uranium. Uranium that's about 20% enriched. Weapons-grade uranium is 90% enriched, and with that stockpile of 20%, Iran could bolt for a bomb and might be able to make the material for a bomb in a matter of weeks. This agreement eliminates that stockpile of 20%, so it lengthens the time it would take Iran to go for a bomb, and it buys time for us to negotiate out a more permanent solution to this problem.
And different percentages of enrichment, does that look different to an inspector? How would they know if Iran is enriching its nuclear capabilities?
They take samples. So, the inspectors go into the facility and they sample the product that's being produced. They actually, sort of like taking a spoonful of chocolate from a chocolate bar factory and saying, well, what grade is this? How good is it? They take a sample of the gas, they measure it, they take it back to their laboratories. So, and you can see the kind of way you configure the piping of the centrifuges is different the higher the grade of enrichment. Mm-hmm. So you can tell by observable differences and actual samples.
This deal also looks like it stops or slows down the manufacture or installation of new centrifuges. Help us understand what that means.
Well, this you're exactly right. There's two other parts of this agreement that, excuse me for a second, sorry,
okay.
That actually freeze the Iranian program in place. So you don't want to be in a position where Iran is continuing to build while they talk with you. This agreement freezes the program. It prohibits the manufacturing of new centrifuges. It stops Iran from installing any new centrifuges. and it stops Iran from turning on some of the thousands of centrifuges they have in their facilities but have not yet activated. So Iran has about 18,000-19,000 centrifuges in their two main facilities. Half of them are actually operating. This agreement says, no, you can't turn the rest of them on. So this is one of the sort of confidence-building measures that allows you to keep talking, knowing that Iran is not stealing ground on you.
But would it be fair to say, just based on the last years of behavior on Iran's part, that it wants to be, or it has wanted to be, a nuclear-armed state?
Well,
can we say that? No,
you can't, actually. It's very unclear, and our best intelligence indicates that the Iranian leadership hasn't decided this. That it's pretty clear that they've decided they want to acquire the technological capabilities that could allow them to become a nuclear weapon state should they decide to do so. Mm-hmm. But there's no evidence that the leadership has decided this is it, we're going for the bomb. So this is not a Manhattan Project. This is not even North Korea, moving steadily towards a weapon. This is a state that's decidedly ambivalent about this. Officially, the leadership says we don't want a weapon. There's a fatwa, a holy ruling by the supreme leader that says that nuclear weapons are anti-Islamic. But their acquisition of this capability, understandably, makes us suspicious of this. Why else are you going through all this trouble and expense to build this enrichment capability? Most countries that have nuclear reactors don't make their own fuel. They buy it from the countries that do. Iran only has one reactor, yet it's rushing to build this enrichment facility. So clearly there are suspicions, but it's not at all clear that they've decided to do this. In fact, I believe at this point there may be a fundamental strategic rethinking in the Iranian leadership that decides that this program is much less important to them than it was even a few years ago.
And I want to pick up on that, but help us understand, I guess, the difference in the technology if you're using nuclear power for energy, for instance, versus making some kind of a weapon.
Well, this is at the heart of the dilemma. In order to make uranium fuel, you have to take the natural uranium and enrich it. You have to get a higher percentage of a particular isotope, U-235, in the uranium. It's a low percentage, less than 1% in natural uranium. So you take that uranium, you turn it into a gas, and you put it into these centrifuges. They look like water heaters. They're about that size. And the gas spins around, and in that process, you're able to slightly increase the ratio of the U-235 molecule, but only slightly, so you have to do it again in another centrifuge, in another. Basically, you have to run it through thousands of centrifuges for several months to get it up to fuel grade, which is about 3%. Mm-hmm. You can stop the process there, but here's the problem. If you keep those same centrifuges going, you can eventually bring it up to 90% purity, which is what you need for a bomb. Same centrifuges, same facilities, same gas. It's a question of how much you enrich it. So as long as you can make fuel-grade uranium, you can make bomb-grade. So what we're looking for in this deal is a way to give them a limited capability to make fuel and have absolute assurances that they won't use that to make a bomb.
And we're talking with Joseph Cerincione in this portion of Radio Times, talking about the nuclear deal involving Iran, the U.S., and other world powers. Any questions or comments, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Joe, it sounds like you're pretty bullish on this agreement. Is that a correct assessment?
Well, every president since Jimmy Carter has been trying to make a deal with Iran, and this is the first time we've succeeded. And I think it's because Iran itself has taken a different course. The election of their president, Hassan Rouhani, in June of this year was a mandate from the Iranian people to fix the economy, to get this economy going again. And there seems to be a consensus among the elite that this is the priority. And the only way they can do that is to make a deal with the West to lift the sanctions that have been imposed by the United Nations and the United States. And the only way they can do that is to come to a deal on the nuclear program. I think that's the driver, and that's what makes me optimistic. The Iranians, I think, care much more about getting the economy going and reintegrating their country back into the international community than they do about continuing this pursuit of nuclear weapons technology.
So then what do you make of Benjamin Netanyahu's statement? Essentially, you can't trust Iran, including Rouhani. He's a kind of a wolf in sheep's clothing.
I think he's making a fundamental miscalculation on the nature of this regime. His position is understandable. He feels that Iran represents an existential threat to Israel. And he thinks that if Iran is left with any enrichment capability, it will continue to have the possibility of going for a bomb, which is true. The trouble is there's no alternative to this negotiated path. It's almost impossible for any Iranian politician, no matter how pragmatic, how moderate, to give up the enrichment capability completely. They've invested too much. They've put too much of their regime's credibility at stake. They can't just walk away from it, but they can limit it, they can reduce it, they can agree to much more intrusive inspections, bring it down to a manageable size where we can effectively assure that they're using it only for peaceful purposes. That is a deal we can get. That is a deal I think you're going to be able to strike in the next 6 months. If you continue with Mr. Netanyahu's position, you're never going to be able to get a deal, and the only alternative is military actions, strikes on Iran that could start another war in the Middle East, a war with a country that's much bigger than Iraq or much more powerful than Afghanistan, and it has formidable counter capabilities. So this would be, I don't see any way to prevail in a conflict like that. So I think Mr. Netanyahu, while understandable in his concerns, doesn't have a policy that could actually accomplish what he says he wants.
About a minute before our first break here, but Israel has a nuclear weapon, does it not, or at least a number of nuclear weapons?
We estimate that Israel has about 100 nuclear weapons, and it has had them since 1968.
For offensive reasons, for defensive reasons?
Almost every country that's gotten nuclear weapons, including us, got it for defensive reasons. Israel was afraid it was going to be overwhelmed by its Arab foes and acquired these weapons to make sure they weren't. It hasn't really worked out. They still went to war in 1973 after they went nuclear. But there's been no... Israel's never threatened another country with their nuclear weapons or used them for offensive purposes.
And how many countries around the world have nuclear weapons that we know of?
There are 9, including North Korea, which has somewhere between 2 and 6 nuclear weapons. There are about 17,000 nuclear weapons in the world right now. The vast majority of them, 95%, are held by the United States and Russia.
And that's Joseph Cirincione, the first of 2 guests in this hour of Radio Times, the president of the Plowshares Fund, also author of a new book called Nuclear Nightmare, Securing the World Before It's Too Late. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We have another guest waiting in the wings as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet me at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. The new healthcare law is here, and Independence Blue Cross can help consumers understand how the new law affects individuals and families. Independence Blue Cross has been here for 75 years, and they're committed to being here for whatever lies ahead. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. To find out more about how the healthcare law could affect you, details at ibx.com.
Next time in Studio 360...
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
You know about the witches and the munchkins.
Follow the yellow brick road.
But the land of Oz is stranger than you ever imagined. We'll discover why this American icon continues to inspire countless filmmakers, musicians, and novelists. The Wizard of Oz, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, a photographer tries to put faces and names to the Syrian refugees we read about, especially the kids.
His name is Hani, and he was such a magnet. He was cultured and educated and carried his books with him.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Joseph Cirincione about the interim deal with Iran over its nuclear program. Let me get some callers in before we have to say goodbye to you. And we've got, looks like we've got Tom from Downingtown joining us on Radio Times. Tom, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Thank you for allowing me to talk.
Sure.
I was just thinking of your guest. I'm sure this has been a recurring question, but it seems to me that there's this kind of fine line between whether or not a country is allowed to produce nuclear energy versus, and it seems like the fine line is producing energy versus producing a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Why certain countries are allowed to do that and others are, and I think you could have addressed it a little earlier with Israel having the capability of producing atomic weapons and actually having atomic weapons.
Tom, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Joe, we talked about that a little bit earlier about, I guess, that fine line between nuclear energy and a nuclear weapon. But I guess the larger question I hear from Tom is should we think about and work towards a nuclear-free world?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we should. And there are increasing numbers of American security leaders who think that nuclear weapons, whatever benefits they had during the Cold War, are now more of a liability than an asset. It's the one weapon that can destroy us, and we'd be better off with fewer and fewer weapons in the world, moving eventually to a world where there are no weapons, no threat to the United States from nuclear weapons. And in fact, we are moving that way. There used to be 60,000 nuclear weapons in the world during the 1980s, the height of the Cold War. We're down to 17,000, and those stockpiles are shrinking. And we're down to very few countries who are trying to get them. Sometimes you think, there are more and more countries getting weapons. No, more countries have given up these weapons and programs in the last 30 years and have tried to acquire them. Iran and North Korea are really the last two cases of their kind, the last two with substantial programs. No country is really sort of allowed to have nuclear weapons, but countries that have acquired them are recognized as having them, and most international efforts are aimed at trying to stop them from any more countries from getting them. And the enrichment facility, the ability to make fuel, that is something that is discouraged, but it's recognized that countries have a right to that if they want it. So, for example, Argentina and Brazil have enrichment facilities. They make some of their own fuel for their nuclear reactors. We're comfortable with that because we don't believe they're going to go to try to get a bomb, and there's a rigorous inspection regime. Iran, you'd have much more suspicions, but it's possible you could eventually feel the same way about Iran. They're integrated. They don't have a hostile attitude. They're not threatening their neighbors. There's strict inspections. It's possible you could see them with a small enrichment capability and not be worried about it.
Do you think if Iran's nuclear weapons program can be stopped, that the North Koreans can be stopped as well?
I do. We came very close to stopping the North Korean program. We froze it for over 8 years during the Clinton administration and up until the beginning of the Bush administration, where they weren't making any more material. And then the Bush administration tried a different course. They thought they could help pressure the regime into collapse, and they pulled out of the negotiations. That's when North Korea went nuclear.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very small, isolated country. I think if you can negotiate a deal with Iran, it offers a template, a model, an encouragement to North Korea that they might be able to make such a deal. If you can stop those two countries, you're really talking about the end of proliferation, where you'd see no new countries on the horizon. And that's a major step towards improving our security and encouraging others to cut the arsenals they have.
Let me get one more caller in before we have to say goodbye. We've got William from Doylestown joining us on Radio Times. And William, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're
and
welcome.
For another very interesting subject.
Thanks.
I'll be very quick. I heard the speaker mention that inspectors were at all the known sites. I wondered if we have any intelligence or information that can be made public that we suspect that there may be unknown sites.
Mm. Is there any way to know, Joe, whether there are unknown sites for inspectors to look at?
Well, we are deeply suspicious of Iran, and they have tried to hide their facilities in the past. They have a track record of building secret facilities, and we have a track record of discovering them. So each of the facilities they built, we've eventually discovered disclosed it to the public, and they've been forced to acknowledge it. So we believe that they might be trying to have a secret facility again. This would be extremely risky for them. I mean, this would really, you know, blow their story out of the water if they were caught with a secret facility. But we keep looking. The only way to know this is to have greater inspection authority, more than we have now, more than we have with the interim agreement, and that's what we're aiming for in the final agreement 6 months from now, the right of inspectors to go everywhere, anytime, and inspect anything. So if you have any suspicions, you can get inspectors on the ground to that facility. That's what we're looking for, an ironclad inspection regime that can assure us that there aren't any secret facilities.
Joseph Cerenzioni, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you back on the show. President of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation, author of a new book called Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It Is Too Late. And we have been talking about the agreement between the U.S. and its partners that freezes Iran's nuclear program temporarily while they hammer out a more permanent deal. This has ramifications for the Middle East, shifting alliances and redrawing new balances of power. Joining us now is Gregory Gause, and he's a professor of political science at the University of Vermont. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Doha Center, author of two books, one called Oil Monarchies, the other The International Relations of the Persian Gulf. And Gregory Gause, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me begin with this deal and just sort of get your overall response to this interim deal that the U.S. and its partners worked out with Iran. What do you make of it?
Well, like Mr. Cerenzioni, I think it's a pretty good deal. The alternatives seem a lot worse to me. The proof of the pudding, of course, will be 6 months down the road. This is an interim deal. We'll see if there's progress toward a final status agreement on the Iranian nuclear issue that satisfies not just American, but the whole P5 plus one's concerns. But I think it's certainly better than the alternative.
So what will you be looking for, I guess, over this six-month period? What kind of, I guess, more permanent agreement will you be looking for?
Well, I think it would have to be one, much like Mr. Cerenzioni said, that increases inspections, the intrusiveness of inspections, that limits the enrichment level for Iran, that basically gives enough assurance that if Iran were to try to break out toward a weapons capability, we, the international community in general, would have plenty of lead time to recognize that. A lot of these things are beyond my expertise. Mm-hmm. I'm no nuclear expert like Mr. Cerenzioni is. But I think that it's not impossible for us to get there. Like him, I see an Iranian regime that might be, we're testing its intentions, mm-hmm. might be changing some of its orientation on this question because of the pressure. Particularly the economic pressure that it's under.
The sanctions that the country was under. Is it too soon to use the word thaw in describing the relationship between the U.S. and Iran?
Oh, yeah, I think it's way too soon to use the term thaw because, and this is the flip side of of the nuclear issue, is that we have numerous geopolitical differences with the Iranians still. I think that eventually most people in the United States security establishment would like to have a normal relationship with Iran, and I think that there are probably people in the Iranian security and political establishment that would like to have a normal relationship with the United States. Certainly that, I think, would be popular in Iranian public opinion. But this is a regime whose revolutionary elites have built much of their approach to the world around a notion of permanent hostility toward the United States. So I think it would be even tougher on their side to come to kind of a more general, normal relationship with the United States than it would be a problem on our side. I think American presidents have been looking for that new relationship with Iran, you know, since Ronald Reagan sent them the cake and the Bible back in Iran-Contra in the mid-1980s.
Yes, we do have a complicated history with that country. As I was talking with Joseph Cerenzioni, the Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, critical of this interim deal, I think that's to be expected. Help us understand the response from Saudi Arabia. Much more complicated.
I certainly think that the Saudis are worried about the prospect of a nuclear Iran, But that's not their only worry. And I would say that it's not even their primary worry. I think that their primary worry is what they see as Iranian geopolitical advancement in the Middle East, to the point where they see the prospect of a dominant Iran in the Middle East. Iran is the major ally of Hezbollah, which is the major power in Lebanon. Iran is the major regional backer of the Bashar al-Assad regime, which at least right now seems to be holding on in its civil war. Iran is, I would say, the foreign country with the most influence in Baghdad right now, influence over the Maliki government. And the Saudis see that, and then they see this American deal, and they say, are the Americans, in effect, giving their blessing to an Iranian-dominated Middle East? Now, I think that's an exaggeration. I don't think that's what Washington is doing. But that's the way I think that a lot of people in Saudi Arabia and in other Arab capitals see kind of the underlying logic of the nuclear agreement.
And I want to just walk you through that. So because it seems a little counterintuitive, I would assume these countries, in particular Saudi Arabia, they wouldn't want a nuclear Iran, would they?
Right, but if, and here I'm trying to kind of channel the Saudi view here.
This I hear
you.
This
is not something that I necessarily agree with. But if you believe that the cost of the nuclear deal for the United States was a sub rosa under the table agreement that you are going to, in effect, support a dominant Iranian position in the Middle East because you want to get out of the Middle East, you want to pivot to Asia, you're tired of the Middle East, then that for the Saudis, that price is too high.
So an improved relationship of the United States with Iran is perceived as a threat to Saudi Arabia.
I think that because they exaggerate the nature of whatever improvement there might be between Iran and the U.S., I just can't see the United States, in effect, turning over the keys of the Middle East to Iran. American policy for decades has been to prevent any other power from becoming dominant in the Persian Gulf because of its oil importance. I just don't think that this administration is going to say, oh, yeah, it'd be fine for Iran to dominate the Persian Gulf and the Eastern Arab world. We don't have any problem with that. I just don't see that happening. But that's the fear. Again, I think it's an exaggerated fear, but that's the fear.
In fact,
that the Saudis have.
You wrote about the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia being the weaker partner in that relationship, and that part of that relationship means that Saudi Arabia, and I'm quoting you here, fears entrapment and abandonment.
Right, and this is something that I appropriated from some well-known international relations scholars who've studied alliances. If you're the weaker party in an alliance, you fear two things.
Right.
You fear that the stronger party is going to get you involved in conflicts that you don't want to fight. And I think the Saudis felt very much that they were being entrapped in 2003 when Washington fought the war with Iraq, which the Saudis didn't like. They saw the consequences as being very negative, as increasing Iranian power, all those things. At the other pole, you fear that if the stronger party in the alliance cuts a deal with your adversary, then your interests will be sacrificed because you're not at the table. I think that with the appropriate caveats, the Saudis are in something of a similar position to the NATO allies of the United States during the Cold War. The French, the Germans, the Italians, the Brits, they worried when U.S.-Soviet relations were bellicose because they didn't want to have a war fought on their territory. But they also worried a bit when the Soviets and the Americans were cooperating and negotiating because they didn't have a seat at the table, and they were worried that maybe their interests would be sacrificed. I think that's just inherent in being the weaker party in a security alliance.
And do you think the fact that the United States appears to be less dependent on oil-rich companies like Saudi Arabia, does that affect this relationship?
I think that there's been a lot of exaggerated talk about that in the U.S. Without a doubt, the changing energy the world changing world energy situation reduces the importance of Persian Gulf oil. But to me, that seems to be a much longer term process than some people are talking about. It's not as if tomorrow or the next day Persian Gulf oil isn't going to be important. And we should remember that Persian Gulf oil has never been particularly important for domestic U.S. consumption. We don't really import that much oil from the Gulf. You know, we get our oil from Canada, from Mexico, from Venezuela, from West Africa. The issue here is the importance of Persian Gulf oil in the world energy market, because the world oil market is just one big bathtub. And if there are disruptions in production anywhere in the world, that's going to affect the price all over the world. You know, the Canadians and the Mexicans and the Venezuelans don't love us so much that they're going to give us a discount if, for whatever reason, production in the Persian Gulf goes down and the Chinese and the Japanese and the South Asians and the Southeast Asians, you know, desperately want oil and are willing to pay, you know, top dollar for it. So I think that some of the more optimistic scenarios about how, well, the Persian Gulf just isn't that important anymore are jumping the gun.
There are U.S. bases there, U.S. troops there. I mean, does that tell us something about the relationship with the U.S. and some of these Gulf countries?
I think it does. You know, when you talk about people in the Gulf talk about, oh, America's leaving, they're pivoting to Asia, they don't care about the Gulf anymore. I think that they're basing that on an unusually high level of American involvement in the 2000s, right? We had invaded and occupied an Arab Gulf country in Iraq, and that wasn't normal.
to say
and
the
so
least.
We're drawing down from that unusual and unnatural level of military presence and involvement in the Gulf, and we're drawing down in Afghanistan as well on the other side of Iran. But that doesn't mean we're leaving the Gulf. It seems to me that you know, if you look at it a little less emotionally than many people in the Gulf are looking at it, what we're seeing is a drawdown to an American military position that's very similar to what we had in the 1990s. We still have a military base in Kuwait. We still have a large Air Force base in Qatar. We still have an American fleet in the Persian Gulf that has its home port in Bahrain. We have facilities agreements and access to facilities in Oman and the United Arab Emirates. It doesn't look like we're leaving anytime soon.
And that's Gregory Gause from the University of Vermont helping us understand how shifting alliances are changing the balance of power in the Middle East. We began by talking about the deal worked out with Iran over its nuclear program. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Again, any questions or comments, give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And tweet me at Marty Moss Cohen.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Policy Studies that prepares students to take leadership roles in developing policies to address important issues impacting our communities. Students can choose from food and agriculture, sustainability and environment, or community and international development. More information about a Master of Arts in Policy Studies is available online at delval.edu/grad.
Ted Williams may have been baseball's greatest hitter and one of the hardest to get along with. On the next Fresh Air, Ben Bradley Jr., author of The Kid, talks about Williams' troubled childhood, his remarkable career, his fits of rage against fans, sports writers, and his family, and why his head and body are cryonically frozen. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Continental drift, economic distress, or the pent-up politics of freedom. the people of Thailand, Ukraine, and the African Sahel taking to the streets.
It's a feeling of absolute anarchy and lawlessness, and that anything could happen to you whilst walking along the streets.
That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Gregory Gause. He's a professor of political science at the University of Vermont. He's a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Doha Center, author of two books, one called Oil Monarchies and the other titled The International Relations of the Persian Gulf. We are talking about the Middle East, some of the shifting alliances as a result of, in many ways, U.S. foreign policy over the last 10 years or so. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to talk about Syria. And as you said, Syria's President Assad with his ties to Iran. What did Saudi Arabia want the United States to do? Did they want a negotiated settlement on these chemical weapons or something more involving a military strike?
Well, the Saudis definitely wanted a military strike, and they had publicly supported it when it looked like the United States was going to conduct one back in August. The Saudis are all in on the Syrian civil war. They want the Assad regime out. The Saudis see Syria as their best chance to roll back Iranian influence in the Arab world. Right? They see an Iran that's basically bested the Saudis for influence in Lebanon, in Iraq. They see an Iran that they believe, although I think this is exaggerated, was behind the uprisings in Bahrain in 2011 during the Arab Spring. They see an Iran that wants to be the primary sponsor of the Palestinian cause, and that had, at least up until the recent rise in sectarian tensions, close relationship with Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And so when the Syrian revolt began, the Saudis saw that as an opportunity to roll back Iranian influence in the Arab world. And I think that's why they're so committed to that. And they've been very frustrated by the cautious approach of the United States here. And when the chemical attack occurred in late August, the Saudis said, finally, the Americans are going to start to use military force against the Assad regime. And this will damage the regime. It will strengthen the rebels and maybe lead to the fall of the regime. And so when the United States backed away from that, the Saudis, I think, were extremely disappointed. 'Cause for them, the chemical weapons were not the main issue. For them, the issue was the survival of the Assad regime.
But does Saudi Arabia want the United States to do its dirty work, so to speak?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes, definitely. Wouldn't you want someone else to do your?
Well, I guess so. But looking at the Iraq War and also Afghanistan, it seems like a misreading, at least of the American public.
Yeah, I think it was. I think that the Saudis would say, "Well, you got involved in Libya, and Libya is actually pretty peripheral strategically. It has oil, but it's not." In the center of the oil patch in the Persian Gulf, and it's not part of this rivalry between Israel and Iran and Saudi Arabia and Turkey that's dominating regional politics right now. So why would you get involved in Libya but not in Syria? You know, more people have died in Syria than in Libya. Syria is an important country. This is, again, what the Saudis would say. Why are you backing away from Syria? Why are you establishing red lines that you are then not enforcing?
Saudi Arabia and the United States have supported rebels in Syria. Are they supporting the same rebels?
They were for a while. The Saudis, you know, there's a persistent trope that says, oh, the Saudis support long-bearded Wahhabi jihadists. Actually, in Syria, the Saudis, who have been burned by their support for radical Sunni jihadists in other places in the world, and that came back to bite them, on 9/11 and with al-Qaeda in their own country, they were actually supporting the Free Syrian Army, which is kind of the more, if you will, secular of the fighting forces in Syria. And that was basically through 2012. I think the Saudis are recalculating now. They saw what they thought was, you know, American foot dragging in helping to arm these more secular rebels. And just in the last month, I would say, or maybe 2 months, the Saudis have started to promote a kind of a fusion of a number of the Islamist groups within the rebellion under an umbrella group called the Army of Islam that doesn't include the Al-Qaeda groups, the Nusra Front and the Islamic State of Iraq and Sham, the two kind of direct Al-Qaeda groups that are growing in Syria. So the Saudis are trying to thread a needle here, support the Islamists who seem to be the more effective fighting forces without supporting the Al-Qaeda types. I think that that's going to be a matter of some tension between Washington and Riyadh as things go on in Syria.
With the goal of toppling or getting rid of Assad?
Yes, definitely.
I'm just sort of curious about Iran and Saudi Arabia, looking at the tension between these two countries. Are we seeing then the playing out of this Sunni-Shia divide?
Well, I think that the Sunni-Shia element of it is really important, but I think that's more bottom-up than top-down. I think that Iran and Saudi Arabia are playing a balance of power game. Iranians are happy to support Sunni groups that are friendly to them, as they did with Hamas in the Palestinian territories. Saudis are very happy to support Shia, who are more in line with their worldview. The Saudis were a major funder of the Iraqiya party in Iraq in the last elections in 2010. That's headed by a Shia named Iyad Alawi, but he's a Shia who wasn't close to Iran.
Right.
I think that the real bitterness and sharpness of the sectarian element of the current fight in the Middle East comes from below. It comes from countries like Iraq and Syria and Lebanon with very weak or non-existent central governments. People look to the communities where they feel safe, where they'll feel protected. And I think that's where you get this rise in sectarian and ethnic identities, because the Kurds are involved in both Syria and Iraq, and that's more of an ethnic issue. But the Sunni-Shia, the fierceness of the Sunni-Shia identity conflict right now, I think is more from the bottom up than from the top down. Iran and Saudi Arabia obviously are playing into the politics of these places and seeking out allies in their fight for influence, and Sunnis naturally look to Saudi Arabia and Shia naturally look to Iran. And that's where I think a lot of this is coming from.
And we're talking about some of the shifting alliances in the Middle East. And again, Gregory Gause, our guest professor of political science at the University of Vermont. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Looks like we have Nancy joining us from Ardmore. And Nancy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I am Iranian-American, and I am glad that sanction worked because most of your experts came on the radio and said it will not work. But I still believe Netanyahu, that Rouhani, actually Ahmadinejad was better than him because he was the same in surface as he was. Netanyahu says this is true, and Iran is a military dictatorship. I go to Iran every summer. It is the number one brain drain in the world, and they have almost dominated Iraq. They have a lot of power in Afghanistan, in Syria, and all that. And so anyway, I'm glad that all of this is happening, but they still don't trust them.
I hear you, Nancy, and thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Gregory Gause, she's saying don't trust Iran, don't trust Rouhani, that this is a country with designs on the Middle East.
Well, I think we're in a kind of a trust but verify situation. I don't doubt that there are important elements within Iran for whom giving up their geopolitical position in Syria and Lebanon and Iraq was just something that they would not countenance. I think that Rouhani has been given some leeway on the nuclear question But I don't think he would be given leeway on the question of Syria to negotiate some kind of Syrian deal that would actually remove the Assad regime from power. And I think this is one of the things that the Saudis and some of the other Arab countries worry about, right? That because these larger geopolitical questions are not on the table, it's just the nuclear issue, that they fear that their interests in curbing Iranian power in the Middle East in general are not going to be taken into account by the United States. And while I think that it's an exaggeration to say America doesn't care about this, of course it cares about this. It has its alliance relations not only with Saudi Arabia and Jordan, but also with Israel, which doesn't want to see Iranian power increase in the Middle East either. I think that they're right that the United States is more focused on the nuclear deal. And they wouldn't, I don't think the Obama administration would let, say, the Iranian role in Syria scuttle what they see as a promising path to a nuclear deal.
Nancy, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Greg, would it be fair to say, or do you see it this way, that Iran won the Iraq war?
Oh, yes. They definitely won the Iraq war. There's no question about that. We certainly didn't win the Iraq war. And Saddam Hussein certainly didn't win the Iraq war.
Right.
I think that it's impossible not to reach the conclusion that the country that whose influence increased the most in Iraq as a result of the Iraq war was Iran.
Let me get to, it looks like Jim from Harrisburg to join us on Radio Times. Jim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm wondering why we have not heard Russia entered into this discussion yet, given its very long history and interest in that area, and which includes very actively Syria nowadays.
Well, Jim, let me.
What's the Russian role likely to be?
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Greg, can you take that?
Sure. I think that it's a mistake to see Russia as a great power in the Middle East anymore. I think Russia is a power in decline all over the world, except in its near abroad, as we just saw in Ukraine. It can still exercise some influence. But what Russia has is a veto on the Security Council. Syria is really the only country in the Arab world right now that one can say is an ally of Russia. The Russians are looking to sell weapons and other products, but the days when the Soviet Union was, if you will, an equal competitor with the United States in the Middle East, that's over. But what the Russians have is a relationship with the Syrian government that they are not going to give up, because in many ways it's their last foothold in the Middle East. I also think that the Putin government sees the rise of Sunni Islamist politics, both its fundamentalist violent variety and its more peaceful variety, as an indirect threat to Russia itself through Chechnya and through the Muslim minorities in Russia. And so I think that that Russian policy is to, in effect, be against Sunni Islamists.
Jim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Gregory, I'm curious about how much you think the Arab Spring has redrawn some of these balance of powers that we've been talking about in the Middle East.
Well, I don't think as much as we might have thought a year or two ago. I think the most important consequence of the Arab Spring was to turn Syria into a playing field. Before the Arab Spring, Syria was a fairly coherent state that, was an enemy of the United States on lots of grounds, but managed its own domestic politics. Now Syria is a playing field in which Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, the United States, other parties are playing into that domestic politics. And so what you have is an arc of weakness, of state weakness, from Iraq, where we destroyed the Iraqi state back in 2003, through Syria, into Lebanon, into the Palestinian territories, I think that that weakness, that vacuum in the domestic politics of all of these places draws in foreign actors because the local parties invite them in. They want support against their own domestic opponents. And so to me, that's the major strategic consequence of the Arab Spring. The rest of the Arab Spring basically was on the periphery of that central kind of strategic contest in Yemen, in Bahrain, in Tunisia, in Libya. Egypt is probably the big question mark here. Right? If the Muslim Brotherhood had been able to consolidate itself in Egypt, perhaps Egypt could have come back and played an independent role as a rival to Saudi Arabia in among Sunnis. But with the military pretty firmly in control in Egypt right now and close to Saudi Arabia, it looks like we're going back to the Mubarak period where the Saudis and the Egyptians were pretty much on the same page for regional politics.
Well, on that note, I appreciate you walking us through some of these shifting alliances in the Middle East. Gregory Gause, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And he's a professor of political science at the University of Vermont, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Doha Center, and again, the author of two books, one called Oil Monarchies, the other, The International Relations of the Persian Gulf. And we began our conversation with Joseph Cirincione, president of the Plowshares Fund, author of a new book called Nuclear Nightmares. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.